back in time to a classic concert? Hi, this is Ed Pearlstein. Each week I play 2 hours of live concert recordings from my personal collection. These are rare, unreleased rock and blues performances you've never heard before. Tune into the Live Archive Show each Friday at 5 p.m. on KPCA 103.3 FM or streaming online at kpca.fm.
Free Range Radio KPCA is a nonprofit, low-power community radio station. Through member programming, the station promotes diversity and a window to the unique personalities in our community.
Our mission is to promote freedom of expression, provide access to communication tools, and to foster the use of media and technology to better benefit Petaluma.
For more information about KPCA and how to get involved, visit kpca.com.
KPCA, Petaluma, California, 103.3 FM. Happy Friday, everyone. This is the Healing Within Show. I am your host, Anne-Marie Lafferty. And looking forward to my in-studio guest today is Sue Farron. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Anne-Marie. Thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. I saw an article in the Press Democrat coming up on maybe a year ago, and we met, had some breakfast, and spoke. So I'm happy to see you again.
Thank you.
And want to hear about all the great growth and everything that is going on in your life and how you're going to be supporting EMS in the future.
Excellent.
So a proper introduction here for Sue Farron. She is a veteran paramedic, a mother of five. She is a speaker and is the author of the book, The Fireman's Wife. And she is founder of the upcoming Resiliency Center for First Responders. And it's going to be one of a kind because it is staffed by first responders.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so people that have been there, walked the walk, mm-hmm. lived it.
Absolutely.
Yes. So just to kind of start out, where were you raised?
So I was raised in Sonoma. I grew up on a ranch in Sonoma. I'm a local girl and ended up over towards Santa Rosa Roanoke Park area and have been here almost my entire life, short of moving down to the East Bay to work as a paramedic in Oakland. Was there for a short time and then ended up moving back here.
Okay. And who were some of your influences growing up?
Well, as a young person, I would say always a school teacher. Actually, a woman who's no longer with us, Mrs. Stevenson, was a huge influence on me. Most of the people that were influential to me were folks who encouraged me in communication, either in speaking or in writing. And then as a paramedic, one of the paramedics that I worked with who became a flight nurse, Erin Eaches, was, I would say, probably the best influence I ever had in the industry as being a female paramedic. So from little to older, yeah, great influences.
And what grade level did Mrs. Stevenson?
She was my fourth grade teacher.
Fourth grade.
Yeah.
Okay.
And she just always believed in me, always had something nice to say, always invited me over to her house. And I used to ride my horse to her house to go visit. It's so sweet. I was in Sonoma yesterday thinking about riding my horse down to the plaza. It was awesome.
Any family members, anyone in EMS when you were growing up? Or
no, and interesting you would ask that question. My mom actually was a registered nurse, but one of the things that we'll talk about as we pursue this conversation today is that, with rare exception, most first responders come out of the same kind of a background, which is an alcoholic household, which is what draws us into the industry. So when you ask me, you know, what kind of a childhood exposure do you have, I would say, yeah, I had dysfunction, which many of us do, which is why we're drawn to an industry where we're rescuing other people, because we've been rescuing most of our lives. But I do have a brother who just recently dropped a part-time after working 25 years in Santa Rosa as an EMT on the ambulances. So he actually has almost as much street cred as I do.
Yeah, it takes a special person. I had a short career in it for a while on the ambulance, and I liked, but also, unfortunately, very underpaid.
Yeah.
And
especially in the privates, not so much the public sector.
Mm-hmm. And I loved it, but yeah, I returned back to clinical medicine mm-hmm. just because I made more than twice the income doing
it. Yeah, it really is. It has to be a passion. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of folks who are working in the private industry will sacrifice income for passion, which actually is both a blessing and a curse. So, you know, hopefully we'll bring some attention to that too. But more importantly, we'll provide them the support that they need without them having to go through their employers, which is always limited as well.
Right. Yeah. And what cities did you serve in, and what roles did you
Well, okay, so I started my career here in Santa Rosa. I was on the ambulances in the early 80s, Cadle's Ambulance, which no longer exists. I was here for a couple of years as an EMT, and then I went down to Stanford in 84, went to their paramedic program, and started my first shift as a paramedic in West Oakland. And I spent almost 6 years in West Oakland, transferred over to San Francisco, and after being on the streets full-time, I started getting asked to promote to be a paramedic supervisor. Then I was an operations manager at times. I always kept my license, always kept active in the streets just so I would have that street credibility, and have really worked a lot of the Bay Area. So oftentimes they'll ask you to come into an area where they're short-staffed. I've worked in San Jose, in Santa Rosa, obviously, and done a lot of teaching, trained a lot of EMTs and paramedics, and been a clinical manager. So for a lot of the fire departments, even locally, I have worked as a clinical manager, which is what I like to refer to as the den mom. To be a senior female paramedic with a lot of experience. And, you know, I would think that over the years I've learned to be very fair and balanced in my observation, recognizing that every first responder goes to work trying to do the right job. And sometimes in any job, something can go wrong. And so what I would do is I would investigate a mistake or an event that was unusual, a sentinel event, and I would just find out what happened and make sure that we have our plan of attack for the future clearly lined up. So that's been a lot of my work has been oversight and management and education.
Good. And first of all, do you have any advice for anyone contemplating a career in police or fire or just EMS? Is there... you mentioned sometimes people coming from a dysfunctional background.
Yeah.
Picks this field.
Or the field picks them, is what I like to say, because, you know, we're asked the two most common questions we're asked, and I'm going to, for your listening audience, I would say that this is just be mindful of this. The first question almost every first responder is asked is, what's the worst thing you've ever seen? And that's the worst question we can answer, because when you run a call, your entire body is in the event. The memories are not just stored in the brain. So for the person listening, it's a cognitive experience. They're just hearing the story. For the person telling the story, their entire body is reliving the event. And so their adrenaline is being dumped. There are all sorts of things taking place in the amygdala. And there are parts of the human system that are being affected by that. So I ask the first responders, don't tell that story. And for civilians, if they don't know it now, don't ask that question. And when you say that, what advice would I give to new police officers, new first responders, ER physicians, nurses, dispatchers, same thing. Become aware of the impacts that this industry is going to have on you. And this is really where the uniqueness of what we do has come to play, is that for the last 30 years, really the only offer we've been given for wellness in this industry is psychology. And I'm not against psychology. There is a place for that. But there are three things available to us: the EAP, the Employee Assistance Program, Critical Incident Stress Management, or debriefings, CISM, you're familiar with all of this, and now this new approach called peer counseling, which is where one peer talks to another peer who's had 2 days of training and there's no confidentiality agreement. That's an important part of what we do, talking to people who do the job. But what I really want other first responders to know, especially the new ones, is this job is going to impact you not just psychologically, but there are neuroanatomical changes that take place as a result of what you do. Your amygdala, your entire limbic system, your prefrontal cortex, your hypothalamus, your hippocampus, all of these parts of your brain are affected because your body is in a constant state of arousal. The sympathetic nervous system is constantly being taxed. So to be aware that there are neuroanatomical changes, neurological changes taking place. There are physical changes, which you'll ask a question here, I'm sure, in a few minutes about how I started this program. Storing the fear and the stress of what you do. And we often say, well, I'm not afraid. Well, you're not afraid, but there's anxiety and anticipation of what you're about to see, and we have to suppress those emotions to be good at what we do. And then there are emotional changes that take place because we have to detach ourselves, right? You don't take a job where you run into a situation everybody else is running out of because you're normal, for lack of a better word. And what I say is that we learn to compartmentalize, and that in itself is going to have an impact on us emotionally. But more importantly, it's going to impact our relationships. And the hard part about this story, Anne-Marie, is that first responders are not trained and haven't been trained historically to recognize that these things are going to impact their lives. And that's what we're trying to do, is bring attention to it. So the long answer to your short question is, what would I say? Get informed.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And everyone is different. How it manifests for someone. You know, it can kind of start small and kind of low, like, oh, this isn't a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But then you just kind of layer by layer, and as time goes by, it sticks with you. It has nowhere to go but get stuck unless you get help.
Yeah, and the truth is that we can have acute events, right? And acute is something that happens instantaneously. So somebody can be a six-month firefighter, paramedic, police officer, and run a critical event that just triggers them, and they have these symptoms that they're not sure what's happening to them. And other people can do it for 20 or 30 years,
yeah,
and they just, like you said, they just sort of get lulled into this sense of that this is not really having an impact on me. This is not really impacting me. And then, like the phone calls we get now, is that I've been doing it for 20 years, and all of a sudden I'm having nightmares. I've never had these dreams before. And it's almost like a crack in the foundation. It begins to seep up. And then all of a sudden they're looking for help. And that's part of what this, I think the urgency of this industry is that you don't know you're in trouble until you're really in trouble. So you're okay, 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 and now you're not. And it's hard for us to admit that. As first responders, we're used to being the ones in control and having all the answers. And
yeah, being composed.
Yeah, and not being emotional. And so the word that most first responders that I talk to, even when I'm giving conferences and presentations, when I ask the same question, if you have a feeling, and anybody in the crew knows you're having a feeling, what's the word associated with that? And everybody, with rare exception, says weakness.
Yeah.
And feelings aren't weakness. That's humanity. Learning how to work with them and put them in their rightful place, that's the magic.
Mm-hmm. I'll say there's a lot of strength and vulnerability, and that's a word a lot of people aren't comfortable
mm-hmm,
with.
Mm-hmm.
But again, once you identify it, maybe put a name to it, it doesn't own you so much.
Right.
And that's somewhat the first step, mm-hmm, is I'm overwhelmed, or I'm just not having a good day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's okay. And that's totally okay, because yeah, not every day is roses.
Yeah, and learning to suppress these things is an important part of what we do, right? Obviously, it's how we keep ourselves intact, and it's how the public sees us as being the ones in control and strong when other people are kind of losing it. That's why people thank first responders, is because they recognize there's this huge sacrifice that they make to be the ones on the front line. But teaching and training them how to recognize feelings, and that's sometimes not a job-related thing. That's a childhood issue that we have to work with them. So that's what we do. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so my in-studio guest today, I have been speaking here with Sue Farron, and she's veteran paramedic, and we're going to be spending some time here upcoming talking about her resiliency center for EMS personnel. And we're going to take a break to our first song. And this one just came on my awareness. We both picked a song called Warrior. I love it. Demi Lovato has one out. That's one you picked, and I already have this one loaded in. This is Warrior by Hannah Kerr. And we're just going to raise some of our vibrations. Listen to the words. It's really powerful. So I start every morning by listening to this song. So I hope everyone enjoys.
Show the bell, pray.
song.
It just got hot in here.
Rocking out.
Love that song. That's the way to start your day, folks. If you don't, if you're not in a good mood after that, talk to Sue and I. Okay, so in studio with Sue Farron, and we are talking about EMS, recognizing some signs, and what to do with our feelings, and what did you love about being a paramedic? What part of your career that you can look fondly back on, either some learning experiences or places that you grew? You were a different woman when you went home that night than when you woke up that morning?
For sure. You know, I can tell you that being off the streets now, I think most of us can say this, that I miss the people. I miss being on the streets. There's something incredible about running a call, walking into a situation where people just really have no idea what to do, and you have been training for this. And the gratitude that people have, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning, they call 911 because they don't know what to do. There's been an emergency, shortness of breath, or, you know, anything that's happened. And they realize in 7 minutes there's an entire team of people who've spent their whole lives training just for this emergency. And so that may be the only emergency they ever have, but that's the emergency that we have been training for and trying to anticipate everything that could go wrong or what could happen. And there's something incredibly rewarding when you have worked very, very hard and tirelessly to learn skills and techniques that you can implement in situations where very few people are prepared to do that. So I loved it. I loved it. I loved the people. I loved especially working in Oakland. It was just an incredible experience. So you gotta really love people to be in a job like this.
Yeah, absolutely. So you and thousands of first responders have lived your life with stress. Injuries, a lot of chronic injuries, and workplace exposure that will test the limits of marriage, physical health.
Mm-hmm.
Why we're here today is mental health. Share how this shift in your life came about, and what are you doing personally to support first responders?
Okay, that's a great question. And, you know, this job is going to take a lot out of you, and you only have to think about or read about what these people do for a living to know that it's going to have a lot of impacts on you. We talked about that a little bit earlier. For me, personally, I actually had been in the job almost 30 years and had felt relatively unscathed. I was working as a clinical manager, working with the paramedics. I felt really good about what I was doing. And it felt like I had a couple of really traumatic events that had definitely required me to seek some mental health help. Just trying to process some of the stuff that you see. I often say that, you know, a paramedic will see, or a firefighter, police officer, or even ER folks and dispatchers will deal with situations in one shift that most of society won't see in a lifetime.
Yeah.
For me personally, this all changed 3 years ago this April, actually, when I was diagnosed with kidney cancer. And one of the things that they said after I had gone through surgery and they had removed the tumor and half of my kidney, and I'd gone, it's a complicated story. They actually inadvertently paralyzed my belly in the process. But one of the surgeons made a comment about seeing a lot of organ cancer in first responders. It shocked me.
Mm.
I'd never heard that before. And I began doing research on my own when I got home from the hospital. And that's when I looked into organ cancer, heart attacks, strokes. I started looking at depression, addiction, isolation, divorce, adultery, and then into suicide. And that's when I realized, holy crap, there is so much going on with us. This is we're a complicated creatures, human beings. There's a multi-systems approach to what's happening to us as first responders. And really, like I mentioned earlier, the only thing that's been addressed has been psychology. And having a conversation with someone who may or may not have any idea what you do for a living. And, you know, this is, we've always done what we've always done because we've always done it that way.
Yeah.
It's really not a philosophy for growth. And seeing a therapist for 50 minutes once a week when you're coming off a fatal shooting or a child killed in a car crash, you know, you're dealing with the stress and the trauma 24/7. And you're getting a 50-minute release every week. And that's like letting a little bit of steam off, you know, a Coke can that's in the freezer. You're letting a little bit of pressure off each time, but it's a recipe for disaster. And I think what's harder is that oftentimes it's hard to get in to see someone. Lots of folks aren't taking new clients, or they can see you 3 weeks from Wednesday. You have to make 6 phone calls to find them. Then you find them, and it's not a good fit because they haven't the first clue. They've never worked with a first responder, and they have no idea what you're dealing with. That's where peer counseling came in. So what we do, what I started looking at, when I began to look at, the first thing was the physical impacts. And one of the things that I discovered was that emotion is energy in motion. That's the definition of emotion. And what we do is we suppress emotion. That's what makes us good at what we do. You don't want me running a car crash on your child, a child hit by a car. You don't want the paramedic getting out of the ambulance crying. Because your first instinct is going to be, she can't handle this, right? That's not what you want. So what I didn't realize until after I'd done some research on this is that oftentimes we run an emotionally traumatizing event. Your local firefighters can tell you about this. We run these calls with, you know, maybe, and I use the example of children because it's something that's universal to all of us. But you run a call with a child traumatically injured or killed, and then an hour later, you're running another call. And you're not processing the pain, and talking about it around the dinner table is not always enough to deal with the stress. So when I started looking at the physical impacts and then training first responders how to discharge that energy, and that's a big part of what we have to learn to do is discharge energy off of every single event that's traumatizing. And you made a point earlier, which is what can be traumatizing for one person may not be traumatizing for another. And even though you may not feel it, the energy enters your body because you're on this traumatic event. There's a lot of chaos in the room and energy is being passed around, you know, and so you have to learn to discharge that energy to get that stuff, because anytime there's an increase of inflammation and irritation, you're inviting cancer into a situation.
Yeah, and not to mention, it's in the firehouse.
What's in the firehouse?
That energy. You're bringing everything back.
Oh, yeah.
You're bringing it all back to the station, and then, you know, multiple crews, and now you have all these people.
Well, yeah, and more importantly, you're taking it home.
Yeah.
You know, we like to say, even though our trademark is putting PTSD out of business, and we'll talk about that in a minute here, that we want the word disorder removed from that. It's not a disorder. It's an injury. And we also want this to stop being a title for people, because when you're not dealing with the stress and the pain of what you're exposed to, that's when the symptoms of that title, post-traumatic stress, can enter your body. But that's something that you, A, keep, like you said, in the firehouse or in the ambulance station or at the police department or in the ER, but then you take it home to your family members. And I always say PTSD is contagious, just like anything else. It's like smoking and non-smoking. You can't walk through a smoking section in an environment or a casino and hope to get out of the building and not smell like smoke. And so you're taking that home to your families. So that's the physical discharge part of it. And then we also work very, very hard on the psychological training, teaching them to focus on things that are more positive, teaching them to change the mental mind chatter that goes on, whether they're aware that it's happening or not. We do a lot of work with right and left hemisphere on the brain, because the left brain is very linear, very analytical, and that is where we learn to focus our energy, standard operating procedures, protocols, the way that we do things. We have patterns, and those become so dominant in our lives that we don't use our right hemisphere, which is music, intuition, art, creative abilities, all of the things that we need to keep us balanced. That side of the brain is often neglected. So to create a more functional hemisync, we really train people in right brain utilization. And what people think is, oh, I don't need that crap. You know, this is this hippy-dippy crap that everybody else uses, because we're often Western medicine, very analytical. But what we realize is that critical thinking skills, when you're trying to be good at the job, even rapid decision-making for an officer who's in a lethal weapon situation, being able to have good critical thinking skills comes from having a balanced brain process. And so we work with right brain, left brain. We work with mental mind chatter. We work with physical discharge of energy. And then we talk about how to have the four-letter F word feel, right? The F word feelings, how to have feelings and not let them overwhelm you. And the comment that I often hear is, I'm afraid if I start crying, I'll never stop. And I say, the good news is, there's no documented indication that ever says someone cried to death. Mm-hmm. And so it's a way to discharge energy. And if you can fix the emotions, the mental mind chatter, the right brain work, you can do that. It starts to impact the relationships. Then the families, because that's part of what we do, is we don't just train first responders on all these modalities and help them get balance in their lives. We also train their families. And we train their families about what's happening. Why are they changing? Why are you seeing this transformation in a person that you loved and thought you knew so well? We train them. This is what's happening. And here's what you can do to be supportive in this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. You were mentioning emotions and discharging energy, and you were saying the statistics of first responders with kidney affected. So the emotions that affect kidney and bladder, I'm reading this off the emotion code chart, is blaming, mm-hmm. dread, fear, horror, conflict, terror, feeling unsupported, being wishy-washy, and living peeved.
Yeah, and it's actually kidney cancer, if I'm not mistaken, the most recent research I've done is the number one cause of cancer in first, or the number one type of cancer in first yeah. responders is kidney cancer.
So if you're walking around with those, any of those 10 emotions, some of them, part of them, and again, you don't discharge that energy, you don't have that release or that outlet or the tools, yeah, this stuff makes you sick.
Yeah, a big part of, and I know that you're an advocate of this too, a big part of what we do is talking about forgiveness, letting other situations go. It's, you know, you can become very cynical in this job without even recognizing that's happening. And you
yeah.
become cynical, not uncommonly, very commonly actually, is cynical towards your employer because they don't seem to care or understand anymore. And really what that indicates is that you're not taking care of yourself. And it's hard to have someone say, okay, stop looking outside of you. Stop looking at the protocols. Let's start looking inside. Let's go inside and find out what's going on there. And then you can start processing some of those emotions and some of those feelings. And when you start doing the work, you know, I know for me, when I began, just like you said, when I discovered what was stored in the kidneys, I started asking, who do I need to forgive? And, you know, the obvious ones came right to the surface. But it would be several weeks later that I would have, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and it looked like a Rolodex. And I realized, wow, I had harbored a lot of just unknown to me, just a lot of stress, a lot of fear, and a lot of frustration, even working with other paramedics and, you know, situations where we weren't in alignment on how we were going to handle a situation or maybe something went wrong. And it's just, it's a lot. We all, you can't get on the planet and be here for any length of time and not have your own train full of crap that follows you around, and it's your choice, right? Am I going to deal with it or blame someone else?
Yeah, and I would say a note on forgiveness is, so it's not overwhelming, is put it to paper.
Absolutely.
Just, you know, just write down if it isn't names, maybe it's just events, or if it's just feelings, and then at least it's not rattling around in your head.
Yeah.
You know, let it go, get it down, and what you do with that, you can then tear it up.
Set it on fire.
Yeah, burn it. Careful what we're recommending on the air.
Oh, yeah, right. In a safe location.
Yeah.
With a fire extinguisher.
But that in itself, that action of just getting it out and then is just one huge release in itself. Again, it lessens that power that it has over you. And I really want to suggest that you put yourself down on that piece of paper because it's really easy to point that finger out and blame, but also there's a really piece inside that you really need to forgive yourself.
Yeah.
And spend some...
You know, it's interesting you would use that analogy because one of the things that we really recognize with kids who are raised in these dysfunctional households, it's oftentimes alcoholism. There are exceptions. People who are generational first responders do it because their parents did it, maybe didn't have direct influence. With mental illness, chronic illness, alcoholism, addiction, or what they are called the ACEs, the adverse childhood exposures and experiences, the more times you're exposed to trauma as a child, the greater the chances are that you are going to get sick as an adult. And it's because we start storing that stuff really early into our lives. One of the things that oftentimes, and I don't want to say this in a way that is too revealing or unveiling for first responders, is that there is a need to be acknowledged. And really where that has to come from is from us. And recognizing that I had to value myself, you know, because obviously all of my energy had been expended being a caretaker, both as a child with an alcoholic mother, but also as a first responder. I'd expended all this energy taking care of other people, my children, and I had not really ever done any work on taking care of myself. And that's the revelation that hit me when I got sick, was I didn't really know how to take care of myself. And it was through learning how to care for myself that I learned the modalities to pass on to other first responders. And the magic has been that my colleague Ron is a retired Santa Rosa firefighter after 31 years. We're all first responders. So when we're talking about this childhood stuff, when we're talking about, like Ron does this phenomenal presentation on neuroanatomy. He does a presentation on sleep deprivation and NREM sleep and REM sleep and sleep spindles, all this stuff that none of us really know anything about. All of that information allows us to become aware of what's happening. And because we're all first responders talking to first responders, they realize, wow, they get it. They've been on the job. They've done it. And there's something about having another first responder talk to you, teach to you, that makes it all relatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one thing you just touched on we haven't mentioned yet is self-care. And self-care can just be just taking a walk.
Absolutely.
But there needs to be some quiet space or some quiet time in there to just check in with yourself.
Yeah, and I don't think most of us even know what self-care is. You know, getting your hair cut is not self-care.
Yeah.
being alone and getting inside of yourself and finding out if you're having feelings and what they are, being objective. Oftentimes we, like I said, we are not only looking externally to help other people, but we look outside of ourselves for solutions. And the answers are actually inside of you. And it takes some work to get to a place where you can actually receive that and then begin doing the work. And I can only tell you the response that we've gotten from the hundreds of first responders we've trained so far is just, it is absolutely life-altering. It's like a manual. It's like we finally figured out, you know, we need a manual to do this job. Here's an operating manual. The most important piece of equipment you'll ever have is not the fire engine. It's not an axe. It's not a hose. It's not an SCBA. It's not even a life pack monitor. It's not anything that's in the police car. The most important piece of equipment you're ever going to have is right between your ears. And we haven't trained anybody on how to utilize that and how to protect it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's when you do the work.
That's it.
And it's, I want to say I've been doing the work for years. I kind of stumbled onto it. I almost want to say it's addictive.
Yeah.
Because when it starts to change your life, you don't want to go.
Oh, my gosh.
You don't want to go back where you've been.
And there is nothing better than having a first responder who comes into one of our conferences. We had one recently where one of the top chiefs in the state was, his legs jittered and he cried off and on the whole conference. And then when he realized, holy cow, I can do something about this, it just transformed his life. And then the letters we get back from people, you know, just thank you for helping us become aware that, as I say, you are the prisoner in the cell. You also happen to have the key in your pocket. And we're just going to show you how the key works.
Yes, absolutely. And you also have to be ready to do the work. There's some that aren't ready to do the work, and that's okay. But it's there when you're ready, when you've had enough.
That's right.
And there's a way out. There is.
When you're willing to change.
Yeah.
And it sometimes you have to get to that. And unfortunately, a lot of people get to that place when they finally realize they have to make change in their lives. They're oftentimes so despondent and exhausted, they don't even know where to begin. And when we get those folks, that's when the fun begins, because we begin to show them there's a way out.
Yes. So you are first responders being supporting other EMS. So who can seek support from you? You also mentioned families.
That's right. So we work, we're for first responders, by first responders. We are all fire, police, paramedics, EMTs, dispatchers, nurses, doctors, anybody who's on the front line of providing emergency care to some degree. Those are the folks that we're helping. We also take retired personnel who often come in. They haven't really ever had any tools. And then we also provide training to the families. So we give them a shorter version of what we do for the first responders. We introduce them to the changes that are taking place in their bodies and in their minds. And we give them the same tools and training that we give the first responders, showing them how to do their own self-care. So what we commonly refer to as being a lighthouse for the first responder. We don't train family members to become codependent and patronizing. We train them to be lighthouses. So when the first responder comes home and maybe they aren't even aware that they're struggling, mm-hmm. that you have someone else in the home who's balanced and it makes you feel like it's safe here. It's an interesting transition with the families.
Okay, and can we give some contact info out? How do they?
The best way to reach us always is through our website, which is Resiliency First, and I want to make sure that is clear here. The word resiliency followed by 1ST, so resiliencyfirst.org is the best way to reach us. You can contact us. You can send an email off. It'll be directed over to me. If it's okay that I mention that Tipping Point, Emergency Relief Fund, just made a huge donation to our organization to allow us to train 500 first responders who are still dealing with the stress and the trauma from the fires. We are so incredibly grateful to these folks for this, and we're going to be hosting a training through Petaluma Fire April 3rd and 4th at Luke Casey, and they're going to bring in 50 first responders who want to come. It's paid for through their Emergency Relief Fund at Tipping Point, and then we're going to have a family day on the 5th. After that training on the 3rd and 4th at Luke Casey. So a lot of local departments have really jumped on getting the training for their folks. We're grateful to the leadership of these departments that want to help their personnel, because we don't want them off on disability. And more importantly, we don't want their personal lives to be destroyed by their careers.
Absolutely. Great. Okay, so that is some good information. And we're going to break to our second song. And this is Fight Song by Rachel Patton. And any special reason for picking this song or message that it has?
I will tell you that in a very short clip here, that when I went through my illness, my organ cancer, it was a very, very despondent time for me. And I won't share too much of that on the air, but I ended up at the bottom of this well. And when I finally started to get well through some help, and I put up a sign in my bedroom that said, "This is not the way my story ends." And I made a commitment every morning to get up and listen to something positive and to tell myself, no matter what anyone said to me, I was going to fight for this organization and I was going to get first responders the help they needed. And that's what eventually, as we'll talk about, led me to sell my home and launch this nonprofit, because it wasn't going to get done in a timely enough fashion. And so fighting for what you want, the most important thing I can offer.
Okay, fantastic. And so this is Fight Song by Rachel Patton, picked by Sue Farron.
Thank you.
Studio guest today has been Sue Farron, and we are talking about supporting first responders by first responders. And what are your goals? You mentioned selling your house. So where is life taking you?
Okay, well, as we talked about a little bit before the show started, this has just exploded, and I am so grateful. It brings me to tears that it started with me knocking on doors, literally going into departments that I had worked for. Sonoma Fire was the first where I walked in and talked to one of the battalion chiefs and said, listen, I got sick. I started doing the research, and this is what's happening. Can I come in and train your folks? And he said, absolutely. They brought me in, and that launched it. The guys actually asked me, and guys being guys and gals, but what are we going to do? Because to make a change in curriculum in the academies, fire, police, EMS academies, it takes years sometimes. You've got to, you know, even, oh, we'll change it for an hour. We'll add 2 hours of training. We don't need 2 hours of training. We need about 2.5 years of training. But I'll start with 16 hours. And I said, one of the guys said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to sell my house and I'm going to start a nonprofit. And I'm just going to make this work every day. I'm going to run until I can't run anymore. And I have been for 2.5 years going at this, trying to make this thing functional. And, of course, the demand has been so huge. And trying to get some funding because I had used all the money from the sale of my home to get this thing off the ground.
So really quick, did you think it was going to get this big?
I don't know that I knew it was going to happen so personally. My intention all along was to build the first ever resiliency center in Sonoma County. And a resiliency center would be a location where a first responder coming off of a traumatic event or even cumulative stress, 7 days a week can come to our center. And what we provide for them are these modalities. So everything from a physical fitness, not necessarily a workout, but some discharging of the energy, getting a massage, being able to do some physical resiliency training, training them in mindfulness, meditation, visualization, and also having trauma therapists in-house. You come off a bad shift, you have a trauma therapist right there that you can go see today, not 3 weeks from Wednesday, who may not know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. We're going to have peers there. We're going to have everything that they need, including having resources for them. So if they're out on disability, helping them navigate the system so they're not trying to do it when they're exhausted. And, you know, you're already depressed. If you're out on a physical or a psychological disability, you're already disappointed. You're away from your tribe. You're feeling alienated and isolated. And now you have to make 14 phone calls to figure out how to get some help. So we're going to help them navigate that. We're also going to provide financial resources and family resources for them, help their families as well. And I should put a shout out there that Redwood Credit Union also just made a very nice deposit, a donation to our organization, and want to partner with us to help first responders. Because, you know, I like to say when I train at these conferences, the thing is about first responders. It's not that we don't want to be financially responsible. It's just that bills are boring. And we're a bunch of impulse personalities. We're a bunch of adrenaline junkies. And so having people provide support and resources is what our intention is. And so we're going to try to have equine therapy. We've got some folks locally in the community who are supporting us and trying to help us find a location to build this center. But having a center that we can start it here, right here in Sonoma County, which, of course, I didn't know when I sold my house 3 weeks before that the fire was about to hit. That was all a coincidence. People thought I started this after the fire. Absolutely untrue. This had been working on this for almost a year before the fire hit. It's almost like the universe had a plan and was trying to prepare me. And so getting that center built here in Sonoma County, that means the most to me because this is my hometown. And then being able to plug and play to get these centers built across the nation, not just having one center on the East Coast that deals with addiction and PTSD, but having these training facilities throughout the nation so that the most important people any of us can have. You know, I used this analogy when I was talking at a Rotary recently where I said, what would happen if you called 911 And nobody came.
Yeah, nobody answered.
What if nobody answered? But what if nobody came? Because if you think about what happens in our community, we have 6 minutes and 59 seconds to be at your location. You have to. We have to clock that. Stop that clock. It's a county requirement. We have to be there helping you in that time frame. And when these folks are exhausted and they're having marital problems and they're being exposed to all this trauma and stress and they're doing mandatory overtime, you know, you're not always getting the best version of that first responder. Yeah. Now, I want to be clear about when I say that. That's not the case in most situations. In most situations, these folks are rested and trained and everybody's doing really well. And so I don't want anyone to be anxious about calling 911. That's not it. What I'm saying is that these are the most important people in our community in many cases, and those people need to have the most investment into making them the best possible versions of themselves. And I'm not blaming anyone. I'm not blaming the fire department. So there's no one to blame here. I'm blaming the nervous system. That's who I'm after.
Yeah.
And I, like I said, I will go in and train these folks anywhere I can get an audience. I'm going to go in and train these folks because it's never been about us making money. It's always been about us getting the people that I've worked with, my colleagues, the people that I have grown up with and served with, the help that they need.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and something great came out of you having cancer.
Yeah, right. Who?
You know what? I mean, it's not many people walk around going, oh, yeah, I'm so thankful that, you know, I was diagnosed with cancer, because this would not have come into your space had you not been sick and brought your awareness then to kidney and kidney health. And, yeah.
It's that's kind of that song that you just played, and that was kind of one of the important things, Anne-Marie, and you're so intuitive about these kinds of things, is that, you know, all of us are going to have stuff happen in our lives. Everybody's got a story. You know, every time I talk to anyone, whether it's a first responder or not, you find out you've all had to take some hits. And the question you have to ask yourself every day is, what am I going to do with that? What am I going to do with that? And I get it. You know, I have been at the bottom of the well. I have sat there and thought, I'm not doing a thing. I'm going to lay here and cry and maybe have a drink or whatever it is that we choose to do with that pain. And then I realized, this isn't going to end well. This isn't going to end well. And I had to get up and start fighting. And, you know, fighting is not something you do once. Like you said, it becomes something you do every day. Here's just a short example of first responders. I have them start doing things left-handed, shake up their brain, don't do things right-handed, start making their body unaware of what's going to happen, make things certain to be spontaneous. Turn off your cell phone, your laptop, your TV an hour before you go to bed. Color, open up your right brain, meditate, do a couple of yoga positions. Get up in the morning. Don't turn on your technology. Have an hour to yourself. Have breakfast. Take a cold shower. Shake it up a little bit. And getting people to wake up and not be numb. That's the word that a lot of first responders use, is that I feel numb. I'm numb at work.
Yeah.
And then I'm numb at home. And no more numbness.
Yeah. Yeah. No, when I did brain boot camp for 10 weeks a couple years back, the first thing we had to do was listen to this specific song. And we had to listen to it for 10 weeks. And
wow.
At first I thought, this is so stupid.
But it changes your neural pathways.
Oh, I'll tell you, within about the fourth morning, I actually wanted to get up and dance. The first three mornings, I'm like, this isn't going to work. About the fourth morning, it's like, it's not that bad.
Yeah.
I got up, I did the dance. And the next morning, I did the dance. I'll tell you, get up and dance.
Yeah.
And
I run. I listen to motivational podcasts. I listen to music. But while a lot of people are still laying in bed, I'm out going for a run. And I'm doing that. When I think about it, I'm doing it for all these guys and gals that I work with. And I think to myself, one of them is not up running right now, and they're going to need us. And I'm gonna be ready. And so the rest of the team. We got a great team of people that are working with us.
Awesome. Okay. Well, just wanting to let everyone know, I've been on the air here with Sue Farron, and she is a veteran paramedic. And we haven't even talked about being a mom of five here.
Holy cow. What are we doing?
We're almost out of time.
We have 8 minutes. Come on.
Where did being a mom come into?
Yeah, so my ex-husband and I were both paramedics in West Oakland, or he was in East Oakland, and we got married. We were married for 23 years, and I should mention that, you know, not atypical to this industry. We ended up apart, and both of us being first responders and both of us being raised in alcoholic households, you know, we didn't know what we didn't know. And so I'm not gonna cast any aspersions on that conversation. What I am gonna say is, out of that relationship came these five beautiful kids. And we actually, that's a little shout out to us homeschool families. We homeschooled those kids through our shift work. We got all five of them homeschooled. And we have now a 16-year-old son, an 18-year-old son, a 20-year-old son, a 22-year-old daughter, and a soon-to-be 24-year-old son. And probably the greatest experience of my life, I got to write a book a few years ago called The Fireman's Wife. And it talks a lot about raising children in a first responder household and, you know, how we didn't get to have a trampoline, or I should say they didn't get to have a trampoline. And they are super interesting people, super proud of them. I think probably the greatest gift I can say, and I think that my ex-husband would agree, their father would say, we like them. They're all very, really neat people. And whether you public school, private school, or homeschool, I will say that of everything I've produced in this lifetime, those five human beings are my greatest contribution to the planet.
Awesome. And job well done, Mom.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, super
sometimes
grateful.
Sometimes we don't give that pat on the back.
You know, it's interesting. I appreciate that, and I want to say it's interesting because if you look at how most of us were raised who are first responders, most of us choose not to repeat that pattern. And when people say, thank you for what you do, you know, or how did you, this is the second question people say is, wow, how do you do that for a living? I could never do that for a living. You don't really want to respond with, well, interestingly enough, I was raised by two alcoholics. And because of that, I have learned how to take care of people. We don't, you know, I jokingly say that, but the truth is most of us made a conscious decision. I wasn't going to live my life like that. I'm not going to let my kids get raised in that environment. And I can say that that was true for my children's father and for myself, is that we wanted to give them a different chance. And had we known what we know today, had I known what I know today, we might be telling a different story. But as my son said, had their father and I not been through a divorce, had I not gotten sick, had what has happened not happened, we would not have launched this organization. And as much as if God were to go back to me today and say, hey, check it out, I'm going to have to train wreck your life in a lot of ways, going to have to drive this plane into the ground, something marvelous is going to come from that. Would you be willing? And honestly, Anne Marie, the answer would have been no. No one says yes if they know they're about to be in a car crash. But I think that's why we're not asked.
Yeah.
Because we've got to get through it and just have faith. Whatever it is that you believe in, have some faith that really this kind of stuff doesn't happen just to drive you into the ground. And it's exciting for me to say that my children's dad actually showed up at our last conference. And he's getting the training too.
Good.
So I'm grateful for all of it, all of it.
Yeah, I believe things happen for a reason. And for me, kind of the worst, I look back, one of the worst nights of my life was when my daughter was involved in an accident and was post-concussive for 6-9 months. That's
right.
What led me to this, which is going, you know, led me to different things. Sometimes the biggest challenges and the scariest things in our life, years later, I came to say, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for that night. I'm sorry my daughter got hurt, and I'm sorry everything she went through, but it brought me
to where I am today. And you're helping people. I mean, just putting me out here, letting me have a chance to talk, and hopefully there's a first responder or maybe the family of a first responder hearing this story saying, holy cow, how do we get them the help? And if we help one more person, do I have time to tell the starfish analogy?
Yeah.
I have this on the front of my binder. This is the binder. It's a little spiral notebook that I first started writing my notes about what I was finding in this research. And I put the starfish analogy, and it's the story of a grandfather and a little boy who are walking along the beach, and the tide is low, and there are starfish all over the beach. And as they're walking along, the grandpa reaches over, and he picks up a starfish, and he just throws it into the ocean. And they keep walking, and the grandpa picks up another starfish, and he throws it into the ocean. The little boy's looking at his grandpa, and he says, what are you doing, grandpa? And he goes, oh, I'm throwing them into the ocean because if they stay on the beach, they'll dry up and die. And the little boy looks across the beach, and he says, grandpa, there are thousands of them. It's not going to make any difference. And the grandpa leans over, and he picks up the starfish, and he says, it makes a difference to this one. And he throws it into the ocean. And that's what I tell myself. I can't reach 1.134 million first responders in the U.S. I can't help all of them. But the next one who walks in the door, the next one who calls us, the next one who shows up at our conference, that one I can help. And that will lead to the next thing, and to the next thing, and to the next thing, and the next one is worth the fight.
Yeah, and it's a ripple effect, because they're going to see their colleague.
That's right.
Who is feeling better, contributing more, who is more present, and then you can't help but have that spread again, either, you know, through a team or a house or a station. It's cumulative. You change one, and it will affect.
Yeah, and we are, you know, we're people, human beings as a whole are sort of tribal, and in our industry we call it camaraderie, right? But we really have moved to, like, with fire departments, they'll do what are called a 48-96. They're 48 hours on, 96 hours off, so they can live out of the area. And now we've, of course, got separate bedrooms. There aren't dorms anymore. So we've lost some of the camaraderie that has really kept us united and strong. And so I think for first responders, when they find out there are other first responders who have not only survived the industry but retired from it, many of us having very, very deep, deep wounds, some of us actually having suicidal tendencies through the depression and the isolation, to be able to reach out and take the hand of another first responder and say, hey, brother or sister, I've been there, and you're not going it alone. We got you in this. We got you.
That's my thing, is I got you.
I got you.
I got you. I hold my space for you, and I'm whatever they need in that time and in that space.
Yeah.
It's just surrender.
That whole thing, you're not alone.
Yeah.
You know, that you're not alone. And that's, you know, that's probably the message I would leave everybody who's listening, and any first responder who's listening, is this sense that, man, when we're out injured or retired or just off work for a while,